Hello, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to the Reading Muslims podcast. This is your host for today, Jude Al-Qurani. I'm a PhD student, candidate rather, at the University of Toronto's Department for the Study of Religion and the Center for Diaspora and Transnational Studies. And so today we have with us Dr. Amira Mittermeier. Dr. Mittermeier is professor at the University of Toronto's Department of Anthropology and its Department for the Study of Religion, where she's taught since 2007. Dr. Mittermeier looks at religious life in contemporary Egypt. Her first book, Dreams That Matter, Egyptian Landscapes of the Imagination, published by University of California Press in 2010. It examined Muslim practices of dream interpretation as they are inflected by Islamic reformism, Western psychology, and mass mediation. Her most recent book, Giving to God, Islamic Charity in Revolutionary Times, was also published by University of California Press in 2019. It looks at the everyday practices of Islamic giving in post-revolutionary Egypt. Dr. Mittermeier's recent project, Ethnographies of God, asks what a closer ethnographic engagement with the divine might look like for anthropologists. What has remained constant throughout Dr. Mittermeier's work is her commitment to combining ethnographic fieldwork with textual analysis and her close attention to the details of ethnographic writing. It's for this reason that she serves as a key interlocutor in the Reading Muslims project and is our valued guest today. Thank you, Dr. Mittermeier, for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. So let's start off with our first question and kind of a classic, you know, entry into the field of anthropology of Islam. So Reading Muslims looks at the politics of textuality in studies of Islam. And we can think about early anthropologists of Muslim societies, so Geertz, Gilson, and Gellner, and how they distinguished themselves from Orientalists by looking at how Islam was practiced by lay people on the ground and not just analyzed by intellectuals in their writing. In response to these kind of critiques, Talal Asad reminded anthropologists of the centrality of texts to the Islamic tradition, and he inspired scholars after him to examine how texts are embodied in practice and debated among individuals and communities. So I want to ask you a few questions, Amira, and maybe give you a chance to respond at your leisure and take it wherever you like. But firstly, I'm curious, as an anthropologist working in a discipline shaped by these legacies, how do you understand anthropology's commitment or relationship to textuality today? And what are some unique challenges that anthropologists face when trying to engage texts? And finally, is there anything that's distinct about Islamic texts within anthropology in particular? And I hand the floor over to you.
Thank you, Jude. Those are great questions. I find it a little difficult to speak about anthropology at large, so I thought I'd tackle these questions through reflecting on my own relationship to anthropology and textuality. And in some ways, my own trajectory mirrors the shift that you've described with this, you know, Orientalism critique and the shift away from texts. So I started out, in a sense, on the side of texts and then shifted to practice and then eventually came to think of text and practice as intertwined. And more concretely, I started out in Islamic studies in Germany, which meant, one could say, stepping into a field that was still quite Orientalist, if you want to use that term. So during my first year in Tübingen, I was studying Arabic with a famous German Arabist who was giving me a hard time for my Egyptian pronunciation of Arabic and at some point literally said we should avoid going to the Middle East because it would ruin our Arabic. And this was a real turning point for me. I hadn't at that point read Edward Said because that was a text that wasn't taught in this context. But the idea, this very idea of Germany as somehow being the repository of true authentic Arabic drove me away from that program and then kind of led me to applying to go to the States as an exchange student. And then I ended up staying in the States as a PhD student. And it was in the States that I found anthropology, which felt much more like a home to me intellectually. And at first really seemed to offer this counterpoint, like you described, right? Like so a kind of reaction to Orientalism or to what Edward Said, the phrase that always stuck with me was Edward Said's phrase of the old Orientalist truism that Islam is about texts, not people, right? So there was anthropology being a all about the people and then at best looking at how people evoke texts or not. So I was very excited about this counter move and about anthropology's commitment to staying close to the ground. And in this early exposure to the discipline, I read things like Vincent Crapanzano's Tuhami, which is about an illiterate Moroccan tilemaker who's possessed by a spirit, right? And so I remember at the time very much thinking that there wouldn't be any place for a figure like Tuhami in this German Department of Islamic Studies that I had left. So I was very drawn to that kind of anthropological approach to staying close to the ground and to attending to messiness, and also to such figures like Nohami. Then once I was in the PhD program at Columbia, I was in a sense drawn back to texts in some way. So I was working with Brinkley Messick, whose own work, of course, takes text very seriously. So both their content and their material form. And there was, of course, Talal Asad's intervention, which you mentioned, reminding us that people don't freely pick and choose, but that the tradition itself has a hold on them, getting us to think about relations of power, forces of orthodoxy, and so on. And also being made to read a lot of theory. For me, there was always that question early on already whether we can't draw conceptual resources from other traditions, right? So we're reading Foucault and Derrida and Bakhtin and so on, but what about drawing conceptual tools from, say, the Islamic tradition? And at the same time, this is the time when I was developing my research proposal also, I kept talking to Laila Abolorot, who kept reminding me that I need to stay very close to what my interlocutors say. So I can't simply assume that, say, El-Razali or Ibn al-Arabi will be relevant to these Egyptians that I talk to. And so my discussions with her eventually led me to even writing one of my exams on this very question of how the textual tradition relates to the anthropology of Islam. So that very question has been with me for a long time. And in the end, I think I settled on, again, on trying to take seriously the textual tradition as my interlocutors themselves do, but also paying attention to when and how texts show up and who cites them and who gets to interpret them and so on. And so for me, this is kind of the anthropological approach to this whole question of reading Muslims, right? So one thing is to pay attention to when and how and by whom and which texts get cited, or how texts come to matter concretely in these contexts and to whom. And then also, I think an anthropological approach reminds us that texts don't always need to just refer to authoritative sources, but also booklets that are sold on microbuses on a metro in Cairo, or billboards, or Facebook, WhatsApp, whatever, right? These other textual forms. And then also, again, an anthropological lens for me has meant recognizing that our Muslim interlocutors are not only readers of Islamic texts, right? They're also reading newspapers, they're reading my Muslim dream interpreters that I worked with, they read Freud, others read Marx, they read poetry. My interlocutors now, which is kind of a new Sufi crowd, they read books like The 40 Rules of Love or The Power of Now. So texts matter in all these contexts, but ideally, I think when you bring anthropology and textuality together, Islam doesn't get reified in the process. But I think there's a lot of thinking that we still need to do about reading. Anthropologists have thought a lot about writing. You know, in the 80s, you had the writing culture moment. More recently, you have experimental writing collections like Crumpled Paper Boat, from which I draw much inspiration. So there's a lot of thinking about writing and the writing of field notes, the writing of ethnography, but there's a little less thinking maybe that's been done about us as readers. So I'm very excited about this project, getting us to think about us as readers and then also how we read reading practices. Challenges you asked me about, I'd say the first challenge, if you're working with authoritative sources of the Islamic tradition, is that you obviously need a certain level of Arabic, although there are recurrent debates on, for instance, admissions committees around whether, you know, how much Arabic do you really need if your interlocutors themselves, say Muslims in North America, if they themselves don't know all that much Arabic. So that's a can of worms on its own, but I think it speaks to the not very stable place of the textual tradition in our field. But if you work, so in my case, I work on Islam in Egypt, so there's always already Sunni structures of orthodoxy in the picture, even when you work with dervishes or other people who are seemingly at the margins of the tradition. So texts, there's no way around texts in that kind of fieldwork setting. But so there's the challenge of, again, Arabic, and then there's the challenge of other tools that one needs in working with texts. For me, one of my, when I think about working with texts, I always think back to a seminar that I took with Michael Cook out of Princeton, which was maybe the most difficult course I ever took. So this is while in grad school and while taking many very theory heavy and dense and difficult seminars. This is the course that really challenged me, because Michael Cook would give us, it's a course that teaches you how to find your way around primary sources in Arabic. So we would get excerpts from, say, a historical account, and then we would get homework such as finding out who a particular Ahmed ibn Ahmed in the text refers to, who that is, and then you would spend hours digging through biographical dictionaries trying to solve these puzzles, which for me was incredibly humbling and just kind of reminded me that training in kind of classical Islamic studies really also gives you certain tools that takes a lot of work and training to be able to work with these kinds of texts. And then another challenge or another layer of complication for me has to do with, if you work with Sufi interlocutors, as I often do, you'll be reminded often that the meaning of a text is not really on the surface of the text. And that's why reading in this context often happens in community or in reading with a teacher or a sheikh. So very different from our solitary reading practices. So that's, again, another challenge or a kind of humbling reminder of how texts are not always easily accessible. And there's the challenge probably for all of us of gatekeepers or, again, the forces of orthodoxy. So when I was wrapping up the fieldwork for the dissertation on the Dream Project, I wanted to ship home two boxes of books from Cairo to New York. And I, at the time, was asked to write up a list of the books and get the list approved by Al-Azhar. Very different kind of scenario than Geertz's early model of reading over the native shoulder, right? This is an authoritative institution of Sunni Islam reading over my shoulder. And so obviously in all of our research contexts, there's an interest in which texts we cite and we read. And all of this has to do with the ongoing construction of Islam. And again, this question of orthodoxy and a politics of representation. And we're always part of that. And then one last challenge maybe to mention is the sheer, for me at least increasingly, what's been a challenge is the sheer quantity of texts. So you might have those boxes of books that you bring home from the field, but then there's also folders with screenshots of WhatsApp messages and Facebook posts and, again, various forms of texts. And so the challenge of having to think through all these materials together and as a kind of intertextual web and thinking about how people relate to this and construct this textual universe through these different media forms. So for me here, the anthropology of Christianity is sometimes helpful because they've thought a bit more about materiality and mediation, I think. But I am also looking forward to Yasmin Molt's forthcoming work on theologies of mediation. Again, also back to my having been trained by Brinkley Messick, again, thinking continuously about form and content together. But then in Yasmin Molt's work also in relation to theology. Those are some of the challenges that come to my mind when you ask me about, again, how to bring texts into the anthropology of Islam.
Thank you, Amira. That's I like that you kind of brought us back to theology, which is what I would like to ask you about next. And I also really appreciated how you trace your own intellectual development sort of alongside these wider transformations in the field, but also how it signifies not only this temporal shift, but also a spatial one, you know, in your move from Germany to New York. And so I'm curious about, you know, in terms of, again, your sort of intellectual development, how your work has developed. You know, you've recently moved to this project, Ethnographies of God, which looks at this, you know, kind of tense or kind of a contested relationship between theology and anthropology. And so I'm curious to hear you more about sort of, does or should a close engagement of Islamic texts by anthropologists trouble this demarcation that seems to exist between theology and anthropology? What are some, you know, outcomes of this unsettling? Is this something we should aspire towards? Is this a problem that needs to be addressed? And how has that come up in work that you've been doing over these years?
Mm-hmm. That's another great question, and one I've also been thinking about a lot. So first off, I'm partially based in religious studies now, and that's, of course, a field that's historically been quite invested in this demarcation, right? So on the one hand, the study of the academic study of religion as a critical field. On the other hand, theology as ascribing to a truth with capital T. That's a distinction that often gets constructed still. And I find it not very helpful to hold on to this distinction, right? Because religious traditions themselves, as we know, and as Talal Asad has pointed out, are fields of debate and questioning and critique. And the secular itself is not neutral or objective. So I'm all for troubling the line between these two fields and also between anthropology and theology, but without necessarily fully collapsing one into the other, because the questions that we ask sometimes are different ones. But these days I'm especially inspired by work that gets us away from this question of truth claims and gets us to think about things like presence or agency or relationships. So for instance, Robert Orsi's work on saint human relations and on divine presence in a North American Catholic context. So this thinking along the lines of presence and absence and relationships, I've been trying to bring into my own work in the anthropology of Islam. So when we say theology here, for me, it's less about normative claims. And it's also not really what's been called Islamic anthropology in the past. So, you know, the attempt to take concepts like Tawhid or Fitra to construct anthropological knowledge that then can be applied universally. That's less a direction that interests me. But I'm more interested in theology as literally God talk and in lived theology as referring to God-human relations. And to bring it back to text, these God-human relations are, of course, shaped and enabled and cultivated and by texts in certain ways, right? So an interest in presence and relations for me doesn't mean turning away from texts, but it means thinking about texts and practice also in relation to the imagination. So I thought, since you asked me to think about texts in anthropology, I look back at my book, Dreams That Matter, and I wanted to read just a very quick dream account from the book, which is drawn from the Book of Visions, in which a Sufi community that I worked with notes down their dream visions, because I think it's a helpful example for getting us to think about texts and imagination. So I'm just very quickly going to read a dream account from this book. This is a woman recounting a dream or a vision. The line is sometimes blurry. Okay, so I was up late that night. It was maybe 2:30 or 3 a.m. I was reading the Hadra. I got to the part where we praised the prophet. I put the book on my face. All of a sudden, I didn't see anything anymore. The page turned white. Then I saw fire, lots of fire, and devils in it. I saw a horse coming, and the man on it was so beautiful. I had never seen anyone so beautiful or imagined that beauty like that exists. His face, the whole man, was so beautiful. He took out a sword and killed the devil. A feeling told me that it was the Prophet Muhammad. So what you have here in this book of visions, in this particular account, is a woman reading the Hadra and reading praise for the Prophet Muhammad. So a reading Muslim. And then the Prophet appears on the page. The page turns white and the Prophet appears. And so such encounters, again, we're talking about encounters and relationships now, and such encounters can be enabled by text, and here very literally enabled by text and by reading, but there's also this element of access. So this is how I'm interested in theology these days, right? I'm interested in those questions of divine presence and divine agency and this kind of intersection between anthropology and theology, right? So this is, I ask ethnographic questions, but they involve divine presence and agency. And so my way to approach this all is, and in many ways, actually going back to my earlier work on dreams, is to think again about texts and embodied tradition and the imagination all together.
Thank you, Amira. I think that's a wonderful passage that you found. And I think it speaks to kind of your larger investment in bringing texts in. And I remember, I've had the opportunity to read your work and the privilege of taking classes with you. Actually, the very first class in anthropology I took was Anthropological Approaches to Religion with you. And I remember being very struck by sort of, you know, not just learning about ethnography and all that, but learning what it means to write such a thing and what kind of texts are involved, but also what kind of practices and how you manage to kind of have us think about what it means to bring those various worlds together. And that stayed with me, you know, over all these years since. And so I'm curious, I mean, you've spoken briefly about your work, giving quite a few examples, but, you know, kind of thinking maybe on a larger, you know, sort of meta narrative of how your work has developed. What for you is sort of most compelling about engaging Islamic texts when you're in the field, or how does that happen? And you already gave us a few examples, so feel free to expand as much or as little as you'd like. And then also in terms of bringing Islamic texts into your writing, you know, so how do you choose what to invoke and who to invoke and how to invoke them? How does that process work? And then finally, what kind of, you know, problems arise when you translate this, you know, live text in the world, in the field, whether, you know, cited or used or recited or kind of just embodied, when you bring that into ethnographic writing, how does that work in your own experience?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think how do I engage texts in the field? That's very much guided by my interlocutors. So it's very much a reading with my interlocutors that I find most productive. But that has sometimes meant, as I prepare to go to the field, and so far having worked on topics that are quite central to the Islamic tradition, like dreams or like charity, this of course meant reading a lot before I go to the field in the Islamic tradition. And sometimes literally what I ended up doing is making copies of passages, say in El-Ghazali, that I find striking, and taking them to the field and looking at them with interlocutors and having them unpack them for me, which I find very helpful, not because, you know, not to hold them accountable to the tradition, but to just inviting them to articulate what resonates for them and to helping me understand and translate for myself certain terms. So one thing is kind of reading alongside, reading with, reading in dialogue with my interlocutors. Another is, I think, paying attention a little bit to the more performative use of texts. So when dream interpreters present a stack of books to me, sometimes that's also a gesture of simply grounding the practice of dream interpretation in the Islamic tradition, right? So again, back to the question of tradition and orthodoxy, what belongs, what doesn't belong, texts have a performative role to play in this. And also texts as a way of placing the anthropologist, right? So, you know, checking out what I have read or what kinds of things I read or making me read, or in one case, copy by hand a book that one of my interlocutors had written as a form of apprenticeship and as a way of placing me and establishing trustworthiness. So reading alongside this performative use of texts, and then in line with what I said earlier about the divine and divine presence, and again wanting to push the anthropology of Islam maybe a little bit not beyond the tradition framework, but asking where's God in this framework. This has meant for me thinking about how text and something that my interlocutors would describe as divine inspiration come together, right? So again, dreams themselves, dream visions are texts, and they're texts that, according to some of my interlocutors, literally are written on Lawh al-Mahfuz, so this eternal heavenly tablet that then get delivered to the dreamer by dream angels. So texts as already connected to an elsewhere, not authored by humans or by the human unconscious, or in the case of Sheikh Qusi's community, texts that come through the Sheikh, so poetry that he receives in the form of dream visions, and that then in turn, like in the example that I read earlier, can inspire dream visions, right? So texts, so the hadra or the poetry that the Sheikh has composed comes again from this elsewhere, but then it can also induce or inspire or produce dream visions. So what interests me in thinking about texts as an anthropologist who's also interested in this broader field of the imagination is a textual web in which, you know, kind of the texts of the tradition come together with these different forms of inspiration. In the charity project also, I find myself, I found myself spending a lot of time with people, some of whom read a lot. So Sheikh Salah, who figures in my book quite prominently, runs a khidma at Said Zainab. So he cooks and distributes food for the poor at this mosque every day. And he was very excited about the idea of field work and ethnography and participant observation. He would often say, you know, you can't really understand what it is to give food, the practice of ita'am. You can't understand ita'am if you're not participating and getting your hands dirty and cooking with me and distributing the food alongside. So participant observation made sense to him, but he also always was reading, and he also always was reading passages to me and always was referring to certain texts and had them literally in his little khidma space on a shelf. So one of these books being the Ibris, a Sufi text about the powers of the ruh, the spirit. So when you move with someone like Sheikh Salah, there's the book and the text and these insights about the spirit, and then there's him very physically, materially distributing food at the mosque. But these two things can't really be separated, because that act is itself a spiritual practice, and he understands it from within that text very much. So for me, again, engaging with texts is about bringing these, these three realms together that can never really be separated, this textual universe and then the embodied practice and then again this invisible or the imaginary dimension. In the current project, so this Ethnography of God project, again I'm trying to make God and the divine a bit more central, but of course texts again can be important as a means of getting closer to God, such as reading the Quran as a most basic example. And what's interesting here I find, or what I have found interesting, is seeing many young Egyptians actually go back to this communal reading and learning setting. So many people going back to durus and classical lessons, or many people joining Sufi tariqas. So again, a communal and face-to-face learning with a sheikh, and not at all the solitary readers that we often cultivate in our teaching and that we often are ourselves. So again, texts still is very central, but I'm thinking about Islam as more than a textual universe, but also as more than just embodied practice that we can observe, and trying to bring in God as a central figure, God as a central presence, and the invisible more broadly. So reading then and participant observation are important to parts of the toolkit, but they're also not all, right? There's also more, because engaging with dreams and visions and invisible encounters, you can't quite capture it through reading, and you can't quite capture it through participant observation. Yes.
That's if you want to stop there, or if you want to continue.
Sure. I'm trying to remember what else you asked me.
Well, I asked about, I guess, the problems that arise when you kind of bring a text into ethnographic writing, but you kind of spoke to it. Appreciated a lot how you kind of focused on each book, because in particular I was thinking of, you know, your, you know, most recent one that you published, which is Giving to God. And, you know, I can't help but wonder, you know, if there are some topics that lend themselves to engaging texts and others that are a bit more resistant to it. But so I appreciated how you kind of brought, you kind of described how texts figure into that book and into these, you know, charity practices, into cooking food, but also having these books constantly there and having people around you being reading them is a helpful way to think of it. You know, it's not just necessarily you sitting and reading with texts or you in a mosque study circle, that there are so many ways the three sort of various elements that you brought in is a helpful way to think about it. And I think it's interesting also how you talk about Egyptians going more and more back to communal face-to-face learning. Well, firstly, I can't help but wonder what that looks like now. In the times of COVID, is, you know, yes, you might be able to have Zoom conversations, but how does, you know, these communal reading practices change with the current circumstances? And I also can't help but think, you know, this contrast with sort of our more individualistic mode of, you know, solitary readership, thinking of this product, you know, Reading Muslims, and that's precisely kind of what we're trying to kind of work against here, is this kind of individual solitary confinement to our, you know, own project and our own discipline. So that's kind of what I find to be a very productive aspect of this initiative that we have going on here. But I'm curious, sort of, you've sort of spoken about your own work and how texts figure into that, but is in the sort of recent ethnographies that you've read of Muslim societies in particular, do you see scholars engaging Islamic texts in ways that you find compelling? If you could name one or two, and maybe let us know what stands out about them to you.
Well, first off, let me say I like this idea, this parallel that you're suggesting between this project that we're engaged in here and the more communal reading and learning that I've been, that I've been witnessing in Egypt. And a lot of that does continue to go on, I'll just say, not just virtually, but there's a lot of meetings and hadras and things that still happen despite COVID. So I think that the pull of the communal often continues and it takes various kinds of shapes. And sometimes in terms of writing challenges, if I can just say quickly, I think capturing that communal and the kind of the affective dimensions of that communal reading and reciting is maybe the most difficult challenge that I have faced. So the kind of what happens when people get together and read the Sheikh's poetry together or recite the Hadra together? How do you write that? The sounding. How do you write the affect that gets produced? How do you capture that in text, in a written text? That to me a quite challenging part of bringing lived text into ethnography. But I think it's an interesting challenge, right? It's a question of what ethnographic writing can do in bringing texts to life as texts that are lived and engaged often in community. But to come back to your question about recent works, I think the one that stands out to me is Stefania Pandolfo's Knot of the Soul. I find her work, both the earlier book and this book, simply quite beautiful, again, thinking about ethnographic writing and what it can evoke. But I do think Knot of the Soul is also quite exemplary in terms of how it treats the textual tradition. I like that it reads or engages, let's say, the Islamic tradition as both textual and embodied, right? And they are closely intertwined. So for me, it's quite telling how two imams are at play in this text. One is al-Imam al-Ghazali as a figure that she engages philosophically and intellectually. And then there's the imam as a figure, as an interlocutor in the book, who's a Moroccan sheikh and healer that she simply calls the imam. But there's this resonance between the two imams, and there's this resonance between textual genealogies and contemporary evocations of that textual tradition that I find creates a really productive resonance. And what I also like about her work is that she puts ideas from the textual tradition on the same plane as her other analytical concepts, right? So say ideas drawn from psychoanalysis or critical theory. The concepts that are drawn from the Islamic textual tradition are again at play with them, or they're speaking to them. There's a conversation. So Islam isn't just an object of analysis. And at the same time, Islam is not reified, right? So Islam is not the other, or this it's not reified. It's a conversation, but there are spaces of tension or unresolved questions. So quite concretely, this conflict or this different understandings that she ends with, that by the imam and she don't agree in their reading of the Arab uprisings. That's where it ends. So there's not an easy translation between these different concepts that are at play from the different traditions. But because they are at play, I find that there's not this othering or reification of Islam that can easily happen when Islam becomes a space of difference. I find that she does that differently. And texts and the Islamic tradition play a big role in that, right? Like bringing together the Islamic tradition, both as a textual archive and as embodied and brought to life through the imam, and critical theory, and the political moment in which Stefania Pandolfo is writing, and also in which she did fieldwork. The way she brings them into play, for me, opens up a really productive space for thinking and for imagining, and that's what I really appreciate about her work.
I think that's great, Amira. And I think also this is not the first time that Stefania Pandolfo's book has come up, actually. And mm-hmm. It makes me think that we need to include it in our reading group that we intend to have. And also, I really appreciated you going back to the question that had reminded you of the sort of problems of translating this live text into ethnographic writing, and specifically talking about, you know, how do you bring in this experience, which, you know, you had to have been there kind of feeling, you know, you had to have been part of it, had participated in the reading, in the conversations. And I can't help but, you know, feel how that mirrors in many ways. I mean, for people that have, you know, that enjoy conferences or enjoy academic discussions, you know, what many academics have, you know, whether it's, you know, a small workshop or a seminar, you know, or even this, again, this Reading Muslims project, this kind of sustenance that this communal conversation and thinking and reflecting together on these texts, what kind of, again, nourishment that provides for the intellect, but also the soul, and what it means to kind of not be having that in the same way that we did before March. But so going kind of, again, connecting that to Reading Muslims, what to you is exciting about Reading Muslims? And, you know, both, again, in this context, in this historical moment that we're in, but also just as a project more generally. And how would you explain this project to others?
But first, I found the project very exciting, and I'm really grateful to Anwar Iman and Yusuf Sufi and you and the others involved for creating this space and creating this, making space for this conversation. Reading is so central to what many of us do. And like I said before, I think anthropologists have thought a lot and very carefully and creatively about writing, but maybe less so about reading. And yet we're all reading, right? So the anthropologists are reading, my Islamic law colleagues are reading, and the philologists are reading, but we hardly ever read together, and we hardly ever think about reading together. So I think there is a lot to be gained from bringing us together and getting us to talk to each other, hopefully once this COVID thing is over, in person again. Because I think we often, you know, what holds us apart is often actually related to this question of what is the place of the text in our work, right? So the many preconceived notions. I think philologists often get kind of dismissed by anthropologists as Orientalists or as people who don't think much about power and colonialism and so on. Ethnographers get dismissed as fetishizing the everyday and not really bothering to read texts from the tradition. I remember being at a workshop once where in Europe about the unknown in Islam, and a philologist asked an anthropologist who had just given a talk drawing on a conversation he had with a Moroccan interlocutor. So the philologist asks, you know, why would you talk to this random guy instead of just going to this and that text? And that's it's a valid question, right? Like, what does fieldwork tell us about Islam that the textual tradition doesn't tell us? But of course, it depends on what kinds of questions you ask and what kinds of questions you ask about the Islamic tradition. But I still think it's a helpful, these kinds of this push back and forth is a helpful reminder also to anthropologists to really take seriously textual genealogies, to also think about texts that maybe don't get explicitly evoked, right? So I spoke a lot about reading alongside and with my interlocutors, but for instance, some scholars have pointed out that if you work on Sufism in Egypt, for instance, or even Islam more broadly, Ibn al-Arabi is quite central, even though his works might be censored, right? So there's traces of the tradition that don't always, explicitly get evoked, or that don't get sold. You know, the books might not be sold in bookstores, but they still matter. So I think talking to each other across the disciplinary divides can remind us of the various ways in which we need to grapple with the tradition, and also get us to think collectively about a politics of reading. So for me, a very exciting part of this project is also learning about the life of texts like the Quran in North American and Western European courts and in right-wing politics. So I'm thinking of the work of Serena Greval, who's part of the project. And I don't know much about that field, but I find it really productive and important to think about the afterlife of these texts in these secular, legal, and political realms. And I think that kind of conversation can attune us to, or get us to think about our own, the politics of our own citation practices, right? So we don't read or write into an empty playing field, but we're reading, and many others are reading and citing. And again, the forces of orthodoxy, the forces of politics that we're reading and writing into. And I think talking to each other about those political questions is going to be really productive. So I look forward to, especially next year, I think, when the ideas that the Reading Muslims project brings us together across our quite entrenched disciplinary divides.
Well, thank you, Amira, for participating in this conversation and leading it as one of the Ethnographic Methods Hub leaders. And thank you for your time in this conversation and for your thoughts. I hope it provides a really sort of compelling start to the project.
Thanks so much, Jude.
And thank you to all our listeners. So this has been the Reading Muslims podcast, and thank you all for listening.